The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 348, recorded on April 23rd, 2014.
Welcome to the 348th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 181st episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Paul S. Novak.
I am Jordan Lund.
I am Jonah Falcon.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry and includes gaming history.
So, this is version 2.0 of the podcast after CallGraph decided to crash and not record anything. Fortunately, we caught it in time, so we didn't lose anything. Well, we did lose a lot of Paul's description of what he's been playing, so he gets to say what he's been playing again.
I spent all day Saturday taking advantage of the sale of Mickey Mouse in Castle of Illusion that was available on the PlayStation Store.
For 99 cents.
Yes, it did.
I said for 99 cents.
They put up a whole bunch of games for 99 cents on the all the PlayStation platforms.
They did. They put a whole bunch of games for 99 cents. And I also picked up
what
Tales
is that noise?
Monkey Island. That is your age catching up with you.
No,
I'm not hearing anything.
I hear something.
I heard snapping and crackling.
Yeah.
I think it's Jonah's age.
It can't.
Yes, it can. I also picked up Tales from Monkey Island. And
ooh.
God, that's a slow, torturous death, that game.
Why? It's Telltale.
Well, that's fantastic. That's like saying why it's Coca-Cola. That's not a reason. Giving a name is not a reason.
Well, you know what?
Let's talk about good things. I'll get more on that rant later.
Let's go back to Tales of Castle of Illusion.
Oh yeah. So it's a trend that I'm enjoying, actually. This update of classic games, you know, to improve the art and improve the playability, and I'm really enjoying it. I mean, they've done. You know, Sega did Castle of Illusion. Somebody else did an update on the original NES DuckTales game.
That was the same. No, Capcom did the remake of the DuckTales game. I did.
Right, like I said, somebody else.
Yeah, I played Castle of Illusion at E3, and I really enjoyed it. You know, it was very bright and colorful, at least the level that I played. I played in the where there's all these giant toys.
Yes, that's level 2.
Right, and you know, it was very responsive, and you said that you played the original version that comes with it.
I did. It came bundled with the original version, and man, that was just too difficult for what I was looking to do. I wanted a nice casual afternoon of gaming, and this was like freaking Thunderdome.
An actual game.
Well,
no, I mean, it was like death. Like, there's no way I wanted to sit through all... There's no way that I wanted to sit through that level of difficulty. I just wanted a nice, enjoyable game.
Young kids back in the 90s demanded that it be rock hard. I mean, all the games, you know...
Well, and that's the thing, is that I remember owning it and playing it on the Genesis, and I don't remember it being that hard. I thought it was, you know, perfectly fine as far as a platformer
game. Watch
you
play it now, you're going to think it's feelingly hard now, Jordan.
Probably.
Let me emphasize that I did not want to devote 1,000% of my attention to mastering this game. I had another project going on, you know, automated to the side, so I really was just waiting for that to finish.
Did have other concerns at the front of your mind. I understand, yes.
Yeah, well, the thing is that when you're a kid, you know, playing a video game is sort of like a job. You know, you don't mind doing it over and over and over again.
Like, I just wanted to play this game through once, see what it had to offer, and then move on with my life. I didn't want to become the new master of Castle of Illusion, you know, for all time, because my priorities are different now that I'm
right.
You know, not 10. Let's go with not 10.
Well, actually, now, you said you owned an NES, and this came out on Sega, right? How old were how old were you at the time?
When Castle of Illusions came out?
I think
it was like 5?
Oh, okay.
5 or 6? Hmm. I mean, I did, you know, I was at the age where you picked one early on, and that's the one that you had.
Right. Yeah. You know, back in the other letter, I remember someone saying that they didn't understand the difference why people picked Phantasy Star and why some people picked Final Fantasy. And the reason was quite simple. You know, Phantasy Star was on Sega, Final Fantasy was on Nintendo, and people had to go to their friend's place to play the other one. So they just...
Oh, absolutely. So, like, there was no internet. You couldn't, like, research these things. You basically could go with whatever your friends had, you know, and form your opinion off of that. So, like, these little small clustered neighborhoods would pop up. Like, these two, like, these three blocks would be Nintendo blocks, and those two blocks would be Sega blocks. And it's like, when you weren't allowed to walk more than a block and a half on your own.
So it's sort of like, oh, guess what? Billy just got a Sega. Great. Now he can go to his place and check out the games he has.
Oh, right. When your parents could drive you over to Billy's house. I mean, yeah. That it was a very different thing.
Castle Illusion was 1990, so I was 21 years old when it came out.
1990.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I first started playing video games, I mean, I had an Odyssey, you know, one of that Pong machine, whatever it was. But the first time I had a video game machine, I think was 78, and it was an Atari 2600. No, 77, it was Atari 2600. So that's when I started gaming. So
I had a 2600.
Yeah, but you weren't alive in 1977, were you?
The year after.
No, I was not alive in 1977. You are definitely much older than I am.
Right.
And it shows.
The year after Castle of Illusion was Quackshot, which is my favorite Disney game.
I would assume, starring Donald Duck and friends.
Donald Duck and friends shooting suction cup darts all over the place. That was a lot of fun.
Oh, God, that sounds awfully similar to the DuckTales skinned version of Halo that was on mobile last year.
Probably, yeah.
That was a piece of crap.
So, Jordan, what have you been playing? Have you actually been playing any games?
I have been playing games. I have went on a binge of getting caught back up on all of my DLC, you know, all of my season passes that have been sitting around not downloading anything, and most recently going through the Borderlands 2 Game of the Year edition, playing as a different class and doing the DLC and all of that good stuff.
On what system?
Xbox 360.
Ah, okay, because I only own the PC version of Borderlands 2, so
yeah,
I can't join. When are they going to stop this BS and just allow some cross-platform play? Come on, can't be that difficult. You know. As for me, speaking of DLC, I downloaded the BioShock Infinite DLC pack. So I finished episode 1 of Burial at Sea, and I'm in the middle of part 2.
I started part 2, and that's about as far as I've gotten so far.
All I know is that it's a lot of stealth, and we can't say what character you play as because it's actually spoiling it. And I don't
right.
think, I wrapped up.
You play as the White Rabbit.
That's Alice in Wonderland.
Yes, I know.
Yeah. Maybe you mean White Rabbit as in you have to either pick the green the drink me or eat me.
The White Rabbit is a character in the infamous Second Son Paper Trail.
Yeah. Or in the mother
you're chasing the White Rabbit.
The pills mother gives you, you know.
Yeah.
They don't do anything at all. So I also played in the space of 2 days and 6 hours Grim Fandango. And for me, playing Grim Fandango is sort of like a visual novel, you know, because I know all the puzzles, you know, so I just explore all the dialogue, enjoy the art and all that. And I did it with a software called Residual VM, which apparently you have to use in order to play all the LucasArts 3D games on modern computers, you know, on Windows 7 and later. Which you can't do because it's buggy the sound skips out and all that stuff. So, you know, and it's funny because Tim Schafer himself suggested I use it. So I enjoyed it. I also finished the third episode of The Wolf Among Us. And the ending is just a wow of that episode.
La la la. La la la.
You haven't played it yet?
I have not played it yet. I just downloaded it.
Oh, okay. Just... You know, they introduce a character that'll make you want to kill them immediately. They just irritate the hell out of you. And not in a bad way. I mean, in a good way. You know, when you get a character in a game that you say, oh, I can't wait to see what them get theirs. You know, that sort of thing. I also, I also played some Titanfall, and I actually used Twitch for the first time to broadcast live and also record my episode. And, you know, unfortunately, my internet connection must not be fast because it's somewhat pixelated, because the action in Titanfall is just so fast and furious, you know, it's... And
la 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 la.
Right, there are no spoilers in Titanfall, actually.
La 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 la.
Come on, Paul. I'm gonna have to edit that out, and you're not making things easy. Anyways, well,
then stop scaring me with spoilers. You know how the show works.
Are you gonna play Titanfall?
Yes, my to-buy list.
Here's the thing, Paul. There is a plot, but it's a multiplayer game. You know, that's like spoiling Call of Duty's multiplayer.
There really is no plot, Paul.
What could I possibly spoil for you? There are robots in it?
Well, now I've seen everything. Thanks a lot, Jonah.
Anyways, sure. We're going to move on to game news. This week we're going to be kind of light. For one thing, there's not really all that much news, although Jordan is very...
that's not true.
Well, there isn't... Well, the news is the other, you know, there's stuff like Jordan submitted an article about the Wii U not selling as much as the Dreamcast at this point. But that's the sort of news that we can just, you know, discuss briefly and move on. Well, Jordan, why don't you discuss it briefly and move on?
But the Game Boy turned 25 this week.
The Game Boy turned 25. That was another one that
that's
I mentioned.
That's news.
That is news.
Actually, something turned 25 this weekend. I'm trying to remember what it was. Anyways,
things that happened 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Someone ran the statistics on the Wii U, and you know, one of the things that we've been paying attention to is that, you know, the sales have been very poor on the Wii U. Somebody determined exactly how the Wii U is doing, and that it. The Wii U right now is at about the same point that the Dreamcast was when Sega announced that they were terminating support for it. And at the time Sega did that, the Dreamcast had sold 10 million units. So in the same amount of time, the Wii U has sold about 60% of what the Dreamcast did when Sega pulled the plug on it. So, you know, the key difference between the two companies, of course, is that Sega was hemorrhaging money, right? They were losing money on every single console. The 10 million sold represented X number of million dollars lost, which just about put Sega out of business. Nintendo is not running down that road in that they have plenty of cash banked from the Wii.
Well, also the production costs of the Wii U aren't exactly
And the
high
production
either.
Costs of the Wii U are lesser as well. But coming in at 60% of a failed console is kind of sobering, I thought.
And also, you know, there was also some news items about how the that the Xbox One version of The Amazing Spider-Man 2 was delayed, and EA's talking to Microsoft to try and work on it. And the thing is, anybody really cares about a licensed game, you know?
Nobody cares about a tie-in game, a movie tie-in game. What I found fascinating was that the Stalin-esque way that they scrubbed it from the website, right? altering the images.
Unperson.
And, and they said that, you know, it's delayed indefinitely, right? They haven't officially said that we're not doing it. They just said it's delayed indefinitely. We're still trying to work a deal.
Well, that's a game that's going to come out on every conceivable platform, no matter how big or small. I mean, they actually have a Wii version, not only a Wii U version, but a Wii version too.
There's no Vita version.
Anyways, this news item is actually a follow up to a situation that's been going on for the past few months. Go ahead, Jordan.
King settles Candy Crush Saga trademark disputes amicably. This comes to us from Tom's Hardware. Intellectual property disputes are never pretty, especially when they involve the trademarking of fairly common words. Candy Crush Saga developer King went into legal fisticuffs against both Banner Saga developer Stoic and Candy Swipe developer Albert Ransom over the words Saga and Candy, allegedly to protect King's trademark over Candy Crush. King's legal action had incited controversy and ire from the gaming community and was the inspiration behind the Candy Jam Game Jam. According to both Stoic and Ransom, King has quietly and amicably settled the trademark disputes with both companies. Stoic is pleased to have come to an agreement with King regarding Stoic's The Banner Saga trademark, which enables both parties to protect their respective trademarks now and in the future, reads a brief statement on the Stoic website. Quote, I'm happy to announce that I have amicably resolved my dispute with King over my Candy Swipe trademark and that I am withdrawing my opposition to their mark and that they are withdrawing their counterclaim against mine. I have learned that they picked the Candy Crush name before I released my game and that they were never trying to take my game away. Both our games can continue to coexist without confusing players, states Ransom, via the Candy Swipe website.
Yeah.
Ooh, so, they paid him off.
Yeah, basically.
They paid him off.
Yeah. They had
to they could pay me off anytime they want.
Now, by the way, for the Candy Jam, I sent you a link. It's all these little indie games that have candy in the title, you know?
Yes.
Like Candy, Candy, Candy Collect, Candy Princess Saga, Crush King Trademark.
Ooh, Candy Does Dallas?
Candy... the saga of crushing
Candy
Does Dallas.
I'm looking for it. You never know; they might have it.
But I'm just saying, like,
Candy Sugar Saga.
One could easily do such a thing. Like, if the goal here is just to raise attention about, like, you can't copyright a word.
And here's the thing: is that getting back to Albert Ransom here. Keep in mind he The backpedaling he does tells me he got a crap load of cash stuffed in his pocket to shut up.
And
I'll be happy with a crap load of cash stuffed in my pocket to shut up.
I can't say that I blame him.
Why do you think I'm so vocal?
I mean,
I'm waiting for someone to pay me to stop.
Let's face it. You know, I don't care if they came up with a name before he released his game. The fact that all the graphics from Candy Crush look exactly. Oh, well, not exactly, but, you know, they're basically the same versions of all the candy tit for tat, you know, that he put in his game. So they did rip him off, but now they're paying him some nice little shut up money, and, you know.
And really, as a smart investor, that's all he needed to do.
Yeah.
He made a product, he got his money out of it, and he's moving on with his life.
Well, you know, he originally made the game to honor, was it the death of his grandmother?
That's fantastic. As a successful game maker, he can go and make another game.
I'm just saying, was it to he was paying tribute to somebody? I think it was his grandmother.
Probably
it was something like that. I can't remember the exact details on it.
So you know, his only beef really was the fact that they ripped him off and they didn't pay him for it. So now they paid him for it, and he can be happy about it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. So we're gonna move on to the next item. Go ahead, Paul.
GameStop's only female executive is fictional, and this comes to us from Gawker. Oh, wow. Listen to the steam come out of my ears. GameStop, the video game retailer, is having a rough time. Aw, poor GameStop. They shut down 2% of their stores in 2013. In March, they announced plans to close another 2% this year. But rather than admit that the internet has diminished the market for physical stores that used to sell video games, GameStop plans to open or acquire 300 to 400 new stores focused on, quote, other types of electronics. CEO Paul, move the cursor. Whoever's purple, Jonah, move your cursor. It's right in the way. Paul Raines just told. Yeah, thank you. Paul Raines just told analysts.
Come on. you sound like Mr. Plinkett when he says analysis.
Yeah, well, I'm thrown by you putting your cursor in the middle of my copy. Okay.
Sounds like you need a therapist.
That was actually a funny joke on Three's Company, you know. But I'm not going to get into it. Go ahead. Move on.
I'm waiting to make a clean break for your edit.
Go ahead.
CEO Paul Raines just told Alan...
You're never going to say analyst right, so just keep moving on.
Mary Tyler Moore Show.
This is remaining in the actual podcast, just so you know.
I'm Jordan. Jordan, move your cursor. Okay, for anyone who doesn't know, we all look at the same document at the same time to do this show. We call them show notes, and every time someone clicks on it, other people can see their cursor. And they keep putting the cursor in a very distracting place, like in the middle of the word analysts.
Like in the backseat of a Volkswagen.
Yes, like in the backseat of a Volkswagen. CEO Paul... Stop it! Okay, no griefing the gay or I'll scream hate crime. CEO Paul Raines just told analysts that each of three chains GameStop acquired, Simply Mac, Spring Mobile, and Cricket, quote, have the potential to become billion-dollar businesses.
Oh, wait, let's stop for a moment there. Jordan, Simply Mac, Spring Mobile, and Cricket. Are you familiar with these?
I've never heard of any of these.
Cricket is a cell phone chain here in the Northwest. I don't know how nationwide they are, but they're a low-rent prepaid cell phone chain.
I would assume Simply Mac.
Do they buy old cell phones?
No, they are their own carrier, and you would buy a Cricket phone that's prepaid. They seem to be centered mostly in low income and Hispanic neighborhoods.
I mean, also,
that's racist.
No,
I'm just saying what I've personally seen.
You know, Simply Mac, I think, is like TechServe.
Okay, there's just a little bit more copy. Where did he get the hubris? The same inner voice that told him that featuring Lara Croft, the video game character, as the only female in quote, executive leadership would be a hoot. GameStop's 11-person board of directors has two women, both human.
Now, when they say executive leadership, they mean the page which they display. It is not misleading because they have two female directors, but they chose instead of putting one of them, you know, as the face of the company.
Or both of them.
They put in Lara Croft, which is sort of like a slap in the face to them. Like, we're going to put this chick. They're going to put this fictional woman on instead of you. You know. So
when I read the headline that their only female executive is fictional, I thought it was going to be like the the fake Sony movie reviewers all over again.
Yeah, David.
I mean, I had automatically envisioned that their board of directors was clearly only straight white men, and that they had concocted a fictional, I don't know, Marcy Darcy,
and put her on the board. No, but here's the question. Why wouldn't you, you know, show your real, you know, female employee? Are they not
That's
important
not
enough?
Are they not of high enough level, in which case
they're on
it's
the board
the
of directors?
What's their position?
In fairness, they're not talking about any of the other board of directors members either, right? Nobody's really interested in any board of directors, right?
Investors are.
Well, investors maybe, but, you know, I work for a publicly traded company. I couldn't tell you who's on our board of directors.
Yeah,
I know who our CEO is.
This is on their page, though. I mean, it's on the page. So whoever's visiting this page is interested in the board of directors. And the thing is, why not, you know? I mean, it's hard enough for a woman in this industry anyway, you know?
It'd be like having Spider-Man.
Oh, don't even get me started.
It would be like listing Spider-Man as the CEO of Marvel.
Yes, but here's the thing. You know, they wouldn't do that. But given the chance to either show that they have women in power there, they decided, oh, we're just going to use Lara Croft.
Yeah.
At least it's the new Lara Croft, not the old Lara Croft.
Don't even get me started.
The one that had the crap kicked out of her Lara Croft, right?
No. Is she still having back problems?
I think
those
so.
Those giant things on her chest?
Oh, that's the original Lara Croft. You know, I mean, Microsoft makes it a point, you know, to put forward their, you know, their female executives all the time, especially the one that basically runs the Halo franchise, you know, their biggest franchise. So we're going to move on to the next item. And this one's yet another trend. Nate Wells leaves Naughty Dog. And this comes from Games Industry Biz. The high-profile employee churn at Naughty Dog continued over the weekend as The Last of Us art director Nate Wells confirmed through Twitter that he has taken a new job with Giant Sparrow. Some threads seem to be here. Yes, I joined the wild, wacky, and ultimately brilliant folks at Giant Sparrow on April 3rd, he wrote. Wells' profile lists him as the new art director for the studio behind the 2012 exclusive PlayStation 3 game The Unfinished Swan. I seem to remember that. Is it an adventure game?
I don't know. Did it ever come out?
Yeah, it was in 2012 on PSN. Giant Sparrow is working on an unannounced game it describes as not a sequel to The Unfinished Swan, but not a million miles away either. Wells, now here's the key point. Wells is the third key Naughty Dog developer to leave the studio this year. Uncharted creative director Amy Hennig left the studio in March amid reports that she forced out, reports Naughty Dog would quickly deny. And later that month, Uncharted 4 director Justin Richmond departed with a role with League of Legends developer Riot Games. This is weird. I mean, you have people jumping shit. I mean,
I wonder what that's all about.
Jordan? I mean,
It's not that unusual. If you've ever worked
in a
corporate, no, it's not that unusual. If you've ever worked in a corporate environment when you reach the conclusion of a large project, people who worked on that project break up and go different directions.
But,
it's not that uncommon in a I'm talking about in a corporate environment.
Right. I'm just
happens
saying,
all the time.
The Uncharted 4 director left.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a project that's been completed. And all this is reminding me of that other game, which people have been jumping ship from as well, you know, from Team Ico. Oh, geez, I forgot the name of it.
Last of Us?
No, The Last Guardian.
Or Last Guardian, sorry.
Yeah. I mean, and the one thing I have to notice is that there's only two big games that are coming out from Sony as first-person titles. One is The Last of Us Definitive Edition. I think that's what they call it, the Definitive Edition.
Right, that's going to include all the DLC and everything
and,
for the PS4.
Well, actually, and they're also heavily hyping Destiny, which is a third-party soft, which they, you know, mm-hmm. they did with the same thing that, you know, Sony hyped up Battlefield 4 while Microsoft hyped up Call of Duty, you know, that sort of thing. So Destiny is the game that Sony's been hyping up for the PlayStation 4, but to tell you the truth, I don't know of any games that are coming out for the PS4, you know. I mean, they already released their shooter. Oh, jeez. I can't believe I forgot the name.
Resogun.
No. Killzone.
Oh, okay.
They released their Killzone shooter. Game, mm-hmm. you know. They're working on the Uncharted game, but no one knows when that's coming out.
There'll be an announcement on Uncharted at E3, I'm sure.
Yeah, but like I said, the director is not going to be a part of that game.
Right, that's true.
So I'm just wondering what's going on with Naughty Dog, you know?
It's hard to say. You know, it's surprising that you know, there's so many rumors and innuendo about it, right?
Hasn't but Sony like I Santa say, Monica you know, been having problems too?
Who?
Sony Santa Monica.
Santa Monica. That's a whole other deal. Yeah.
Well, in their case, the God of War Ascension just failed.
God of War Ascension just failed. They dropped $100 million on another game that ended up going nowhere and is now canceled. The guy behind God of War is out. There's some ugliness going on there. But, you know, the big games coming for the PlayStation 4 besides Destiny, you have all the usual multi-platform stuff like Watch Dogs.
Yeah, yeah. Here's the thing is that now we're having questions about Watch Dogs. There's some serious questions about Watch Dogs, you know. For one thing, if you notice any of the new gameplay stuff, the characters are a lot softer. In other words, they're not, you know, sharply defined. It's sort of like it looks like they're cutting back on graphics.
I've heard that complaint, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, what they've had to do with this delay, right? Usually the delay is to make it better, not make things worse.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, they're cutting back on graphics, presumably so that they can maintain the gameplay promises, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, the entire thing about is an open world in which you have control over all the electronics, blah, blah, blah. But that's going to be very, very, you know, resource intensive. So I'm wondering if they're just saying, you know what, we have a choice. Either we lower the resolution and make the characters blocky, or we remove features. And I think they'd rather make it a little less blocky.
Right. So besides Watch Dogs, you have stuff like The Division, which everyone is looking forward to.
What's going on with Ubisoft right now with Watch Dogs, and also The Crew, which is having its own little problems.
The Crew is having its own little problems.
So I'm wondering
what's going on
with Ubisoft.
As was Drive Club. Drive Club also had issues, including you know, close to a complete reboot on Drive Club, from what I understand.
You know, what I really find strange is that Gran Turismo is a PS3 game. Gran Turismo 6.
Yeah.
I still find that very strange. I mean,
well, it takes them forever to get a Gran Turismo game out the door, so that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, it took 5 freaking years to get a PSP version out the door, so yeah.
So, Paul, your perspectives being the developer here.
I'm just kind of concerned about what's going on over at Naughty Dog. I mean, it could be anything from, you know, individuals just wanting to move on, finding better, more lucrative opportunities, to not wanting to work with a dick. I mean, there's just too much. There's just too much to go on other than, that's interesting.
Well, like they said, that Emmy Hennig was reportedly forced out. No one knows the real story. But if that's the case, then you could easily see some of the other veterans saying, yeah, we don't like what's going on and we're out of here, buddy. You know, that
well, and the other thing too is that, you know, The Last of Us was a huge success story,
right?
And so, you know, after that game, and you get all these Game of the Year awards, pretty much anybody involved with it can write their own ticket. So,
but one of them left, you know, but Uncharted also can write your own ticket too, you know,
that's true.
And
but Uncharted is, you know, a year away, you know. If we're lucky, it'll be out in time for Christmas. I doubt it. I think it'll be 2015.
I'd be inclined to believe you, Jordan, except for the fact that one person did not leave on their own accord.
Right.
Apparently. You know, so.
Well, and she said that wasn't the case, too. So.
Yeah, she has to say that because she doesn't want to seem like a malcontent, you know, when she's trying to get another job.
Exactly.
You know, I mean. There's smoke there, you know. There might be a fire. Anyways, so we are going to do something special for the gaming history this week.
Yes, I've been curious about what this format is in our show notes here.
So, Games Radar has released a new, you know, article, and it's 10 gaming fads that aren't around anymore. You know, and this is going to be.
I think fads might be a little bit harsh, having looked at the article.
You know, but not maybe fads, but things that you did with consoles that no longer apply now. You know, things that you might be nostalgic about. Let's just say this is a nostalgia thing.
I wouldn't say nostalgia, but definitely limitations of the space would be something that I would run with, or generally held conventions of the 90s.
So we're gonna start discussing some of the. Well, let's. Put fads in quotes for now, for lack of a better word. The first one is Blockbuster exclusives. Back when console-based consoles ruled the roost and the aftermarket of the EB Games or GameStop didn't exist yet, renting video games was all the rage. It was the ideal to try before you buy, giving you your weekend demo. However, Blockbuster sometimes worked with publishers to get exclusive content, either with enhanced versions you couldn't find in store, like Clay Fighter 63rd and 1/3 Sculptor's Cut, Final Fight Guy, or even entire games that were rental only, like Kagane, The Final Conflict, Razor Freestyle Scooter on the Nintendo 64. The closer you get to owning these games, to rent them over and over, or attempt to get them away with the old five-finger discount. Now, of course, Blockbuster is dead, and developers will just make widely accessible DLC instead of giving Gamefly a chunk of exclusive content. So, did you ever rent cartridges way back when?
You know, I did not know that this was a thing until about 2 minutes ago.
Really? How about you, Jordan?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
I remember renting cartridges. I don't recall any Blockbuster exclusive cartridges.
Really? Yeah, I mean, if this was a marketing thing, then, like, they really didn't do a great job of letting players know that was exclusive content.
It was a big thing. Maybe you two didn't do it, but, yeah. I mean, and up to the very end, Blockbuster was renting games, you know, so...
Blockbuster story, I went into one, this would have been in the early to mid 90s, and I asked if they had any Sega CD games, and they went, what's the Sega CD? And I said, well, it goes on the bottom of the Sega Genesis, and, you know, the games, instead of coming on a cartridge, they come on a 5-inch disc, like a music CD. And the guy at Blockbuster went, they can do that?
Okay, so the next one, I'm definitely sure both of you are well aware of, okay? The next one is Hint Hotlines. Well, stuck in a game? Well, before there were game facts, you had to figure out a get away past the video game stumbling block, you could either spend $20 on a strategy guide, or you could call Nintendo and other people to call up the Hint Hotline that would walk you through it step by step, all while, you know, getting charged per the minute. Nowadays, of course, there's something we like to call the internet, which has made this, you know, sort of like non-issue. You know, if those go to GameFAQs and all that stuff. So let me ask you a question. Did you ever call a gaming hotline?
I actually did once in my youth. I was playing, and I remember exactly what the hell was going on, too, because it was such a nightmare. It was one of the Final Fantasy games for the Game Boy, for the original Game Boy. And it was, I was stuck on this level, and you had to do this whole nonsense in order to get to the point where I was stuck. And you got into these, into this room where all the floor tiles had been replaced with tiles that looked like little crystal balls.
Right.
And you had to pick the right ball. Okay. There was nothing differentiating about them. There was no clue anywhere else in the game. It was just supposed to be luck. And you know what? I would have done. And if you picked the wrong ball, you would have gotten attacked and summarily killed.
Now, because here's a question.
Something that was far too difficult.
Did you have to start from the beginning again, all the way from the beginning, or was there a save point? Or?
Well, I mean, the save point was a good 20 or so minutes back.
Okay.
And it was a it was really difficult. Like, sometimes you didn't even make it that far.
So
I was just, so I had talked my single mother into, you know, letting me call after like 3 days. Like, I was like, Mom, it's been 3 days. I can't take it anymore. I'm about to. And at that point, she was like, okay, well, the game's keeping him quiet. And, you know, the game's keeping him quiet. And if I have to spend $10 to continue my $30 investment, then okay, fine.
And did you get an answer?
Yeah. And you know what? It was such a disturbing experience because I had to sit and wait while the person looked it up in a book. Like, this wasn't a pro. This was a customer service person.
Yeah.
Like, so they had to like go to their Game Boy binder, pull it down off the shelf, flip to the game and look up what my problem was. Like, you know what I mean? Like, this wasn't someone who played video games. This is somebody who was making minimum wage, answering the phone and looking shit up for you.
So the thing that I remember actually is, remember in The Wizard, they actually, the movie The Wizard, 1980, hey, 25th anniversary of The Wizard. They actually Fred had him Savage call up the thing to show how helpful these people are.
I don't remember them doing that. Now I have to watch The Wizard again.
But the other thing is that people really complained about certain games in which it would be impossible to get move forward unless you got the hints. And the one that everybody points to is Castlevania 2, Simon's Quest. Because there was something you had
tell
to
me
do
what the problem was there.
You had to do some sort of weird thing with a flute or to turn something, you know. And
one
the only
time at band camp.
You know, and the thing is, the only way you could do it is either pick up that issue of Nintendo Power, which actually had the thing, or do a hint line. And it was impossible because it was something that was so incredibly random, you couldn't stumble over it. You know, you had to do certain things. And I'm pretty sure.
I remember there being one point where you had to walk as far as you could to the right because they kept telling you Dracula's castle was further to the right. And then you got through a wall. And the only way that you could get past the wall would be to play the flute. And then a wind would come pick you up like in Zelda and move you past that rock. But I don't remember. Like, I remember doing that. I don't remember how I found out about it, though.
Yeah.
But I could definitely see, based on the clues that I remember, people going like, wait, they said Dracula's castle was further to the right. I can't go any further to the right.
Right. I'm trying to find the thing there. But the thing is, it was notorious for requiring a guide in order to complete the game because it would be impossible without it, you know.
Well, I mean,
I never used the hint line. I remember the hint books, right? All the Sierra Online games had hint books.
I had it for Infocom, and they had a really cool way of doing it for Infocom. It was like you know, you had this pen which would make words visible, and it would actually give you a small hint, then a bigger hint, and then it would tell you exactly what you had to do. So it's sort of like, here's a little hint, you know.
Right.
And then if you didn't get that, then okay, try this. And then if you didn't get, okay, fine, you have to do this.
You know? I remember when the official Nintendo strategy guide came out, and it was like this black covered book that gave you literally tips on every game available for the
NES. It was thick as a phone book, wasn't it?
It was, and that's exactly what it was. It was like the encyclopedia of getting to the end of game. And now it was up to date for, I think, maybe a month or two before new games came out. But like for a long time, like just about every book was in this. I mean, it was almost this. It was almost a phone book.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to move on to the next one. And I know Jordan's ears are going to perk up at this one. The next gaming fad that we used to have are demo discs. Getting the latest issue of Official PlayStation Magazine or PC Gamer. Sometimes you'd get a CD-ROM on the back in plastic wrap packaging. You could pop that sucker into your PC or your console, and you'd have 7 or 8 game demos plus extras. I know that later on, PC Gamer actually started releasing free games on it. And now, print media don't have demo discs because you can just download them now because the internet, from PlayStation Network, Xbox Live. Of course,
Nintendo also.
And one of our current complaints is that you don't even get demos there anymore either.
Yeah, demos have kind of gone away at this point, which is kind of a shame. But I think what's replacing it is if you're interested in a game, and this is something that both the PS4 and the Xbox One can do, is you just flip over and watch a live stream of somebody playing it.
Or you just go to YouTube.
Yeah.
And also, I remember way back when, the reviews for games would come out like one or 2 months after the game was released,
Yeah.
So you couldn't get instant reviews, You had to either take a leap of faith, get a demo, or just wait for the reviews to come out,
Right.
So tell us the joy of having demo discs, Jordan, because I know that you really enjoyed them.
Well, there weren't just magazine discs, right? I mean, you could actually Sony, when the original PlayStation came out in 1995, you could subscribe to a demo disc and they would mail it to you. And every month you would get this disc in the mail that would have a whole bunch of different stuff on it. And it was fascinating. And, a lot of it was early play type stuff. There were occasionally games that never actually ever saw the light of day. But, I still have all of mine. I still have all of these games. It was the first time I ever saw Silent Hill was on a demo disc.
The fourth issue of Official Xbox Magazine came with exclusive characters for Dead or Alive 3. And I remember that was a very important thing because, you couldn't get it online, even though they had DLC, but it was very primitive. The only way you could get the special stuff was to get it on issue 4. So that I think that really launched that magazine too, because everybody wanted those DC. How about you, Paul? Did you get demo discs?
The demo disc that I remember getting most wasn't from anything like PC Gamer, because I didn't even know they were doing demo discs as far back as Final Fantasy X-2, which the image here in the list suggests. But I remember getting one back in the days of the original System Shock. And you had to pay like 99 cents for them. And the draw there was that like they would say things on the front like 1,000 games or 5,000 games or whatever. This insane thing for like $1, $10 maybe. And it would be demos. It would be the entire first level of System Shock, which is exactly how I learned to play that game. And I'm like, oh my God, I need the full version of this because I just got in the elevator and I was finally allowed to press the button for floor number 2 and it's over. And then you had to go back and do all that work all over again. I mean, God, it was maddening. I'm assuming that, like, for example, for Final Fantasy X-2, you would be able to play the first, 3-4 hours, and then it would say, okay, you're done now. And if you went out and bought the real version of that game, like, you'd just be able to continue.
Yeah. They also had trailers, which was something that you really didn't get to see all that much. Because YouTube didn't exist then, so they had trailers on those discs too. Now, this is going a little bit, but need I mention the AOL demo discs too that you would get, became coasters?
Oh, you mean the coasters?
Yeah. And first the 3.5-inch floppies, then the CDs, Those are actually kind of useful because sometimes my AOL get corrupted, and the only way I could install it was to use those discs to reinstall it.
Everybody had like that one spare copy just in case.
Yeah. But generally, you could have a stack of those things. So
I knew someone once in college who had taken a whole bunch of those and used them as like wall decorations. Just attached them to the wall.
I remember somebody actually built the house out of them. I'm trying to remember, you know, sort of like when you build those houses out of Coke bottles. Someone actually built a house out of them. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next one. And again, this one, Jordan's ears are going to perk up a little bit. Physical DRM. If it wasn't an educational video, it couldn't convince you not to copy that floppy, or there was a massive threat to the earnings of the hardworking game developers. In an effort to combat rampant piracy, developers had to devise clever ways to verify paying customers before always-on DRM was a thing. PC games would often come with feelies, an affectionate term for any physical objects that were included in the game box, but it also could double as copy protection. You probably heard of Monkey Island's Dollar Pirate situation. Other famous example includes the King's Quest 3 puzzle that required the manual and the worm's black ink on black paper code sheet. I believe all the Gold Box games did that too, with a little disc wheel. EA did that as well. And we all remember Wasteland, Jordan. Remember Wasteland? Actually, paragraphs from the book. Now, you know, piracy is an unstoppable force, but it's kind of silly to try and use physical DRM, because all they would do is photocopy it and, you know, send the scans out and all that stuff. Now they have to be a little bit more clever, like you wouldn't know that Batman couldn't glide until it was too late in the game, you know, in Batman Arkham Asylum. So, Jordan, regale us with your memories of the physical DRM.
Yeah, the physical DRM was a huge deal, and the photocopies of it all got passed around. It was trivial to defeat, and in some cases, the section of the game that required that would just be physically removed by people modifying the game.
I remember Sid Mer- the Railroad Tycoon DRM, which just had you look at a train in the back, right? And, you know, I didn't mind that. As a matter of fact, you know, I started being able to identify the trains on site. So it's sort of like, you know, you're becoming a train expert. You can identify what that train is just by looking at it now. How about you, Paul? Did you deal with physical DRM?
You want to know something? I had no idea that that's why that you used to get feelies. I just thought it was, I thought it was fun. I thought it was because, I mean, usually they were high quality things, or at least the ones.
And they're also related to the game itself. I mean, you know,
right. It would be like a cloth map of the kingdom.
Yeah, like the dial-up pirate thing, you know, in which you had to do the circle as Angelina and Tortuga and all that stuff, you know, and they would create faces on each of the characters.
But I had no idea that's why they were doing this. I thought it was just stuff that they couldn't fit on the disc.
I didn't know that the Wasteland paragraphs were DRM either until, and you know, here's a tricky thing. You know, Bard's Tale, those spells were also DRM, and I didn't realize it at the time. You know, the spells were four-letter codes in order to use them, right? And in order to use them, you know, sometimes you get new spells that you'd have to look it up in the book. It's, oh, that's what it does, you know, so.
Well, I mean, if you're going to go that far, you might as well just say the entire keyboard command set of the Ultima games was DRM, right?
No, because that you could experiment. A for attack, come on. So we're going to move on to the next item. Gathering paper slips in the Toys R Us games aisles. You could look, but you couldn't touch. The gaming section of the Toys R Us during the 90s was sensory overload to young gamers. Rows upon rows of Super Nintendo, Game Boy, and Genesis box art as far as the eye could see. And that was the box art was only go on if you're considering a purchase, because there were only sample boxes on displays. Your choice is a big deal, because you probably couldn't buy games without the aid of birthday or holiday bonuses. Once you made your pick, you simply grabbed a representative slip of paper and took it to the cashier, who would dip into a top-secret mirrored glass room to snag a copy of the respective game. Now you just obviously you don't have to do that anymore. You just have the casing. Did you ever do that with the paper slips?
Not only do I remember this, I first of all, I can understand why they're doing it. They still do things like this at Costco.
Yeah.
But not only do I remember this being a thing, but we used to take the paper slips thinking that like they wouldn't sell one without this paper slip.
So you were reserving your copy, huh?
Right. Exactly. We'd be like, oh, well, we're going to save. I'm going to take home this $60 price tag. And it's like, And they'll keep it for me as long as I have it. Like, wait, you really think they have this $60 piece of merchandise sitting in the back and no piece of paper that they're not just going to print another one?
How about you?
So, yeah.
Jordan?
That was,
you, I very much remember that. And what they used to do is they would have a scanned and printed copy of the front and the back of the box on a little plastic tag, and you could flip it up and look at the back. And if you decided that was a game you wanted, just ripped off the paper tag and took it up to the front and paid for it. I just find it hilarious that, you know, they're talking about all of this stuff when we were kids in the 90s, and I was like 20, 21, 22.
Well,
I was selling games to these kids. So, yeah, it's all my fault.
Yeah,
I'm also finding the picture I'm also finding the picture that they have on this list really, really funny because, dude, Golden Axe, $60.
I know. Yeah.
Well, you know, the games were astronomical. I bought Ultima 4 for $84. You know?
Tommy Lasorda Baseball.
Wow. So the next.
Yeah, but the greatest thing about that is that there's no slips in the picture under Tommy Lasorda. That shit sold out.
Tommy Lasorda Baseball was huge.
So the thing is that, just so you know, it's still recording. just to ease your mind. So the next item is games as cereal box prizes. Remember Chex Quest? This is simply this seemingly innocuous CD-ROM, which came and packaged with boxes of Chex cereal, actually changed lives. Instead of a crappy plastic toy or some temporary tattoos, kids that ate a balanced breakfast were rewarded with non-violent reskinned clone of Doom. That's about as incredible a cereal box packet as a promotion can get. It wasn't just limited to Chex. You could get extras such as Sunny's Race for chocolatey taste, Sunny's Race for the chocolatey taste from Cocoa Puffs, and Captain Crunch's Crunchling Adventure from Captain Crunch. Getting a free game was already as exciting as all get out, but it was actually good, as with Chex Quest. Now, actually, instead of physical media, you just get a code to download it. Although there was a Comrade Crunch cereal which contained a floppy disk with Jazz Punk on it. And it was a Steam code, but it still was a floppy disk. So,
well, and you know what? It is, you know, all Advergaming, which Advergaming still exists today. But, like, oftentimes, like, for example, if you go to thehub.com, you know, you'll see games starring all of their television characters, like My Little Pony.
Remember, we go back to where you were looking at the things, $60 for games, $50 for games. Here, you were getting a free game for a box of cereal, and who cares if it was something that was reskinned or was just, you know, you were getting a free game, man. You know,
Well, I mean, also at the time, you didn't even know what the hell reskinning was. I mean, the amount of ignorance I cannot hammer into our listeners' heads enough. But it's just like, we take it for granted now that we know what reskinning is. People didn't know back then.
But, you know, even if it wasn't reskinned, I mean, you know, these platformers, these simple platformers that came with it. I mean, you know, you were a kid. You got a free game. You had, you know, you weren't exactly worried about that much of quality. I mean, if a game really, really stunk, you knew it. But an average game was still great. Especially since you didn't have that many that you could get, you know. I remember when I was with the 2600, you know, it's like it's the crappiest stuff, like, you know, getting blackjack on the 2600. It's a game! Yeah, it's a cheap blackjack thing. I don't care, it's a game! You're not playing for any money.
Yeah, and
it's a game!
And aside from that, like, in the console days, like, you really did have a lot more trust in the fact that it had made it to the console. I mean, you knew that if you bought it, it shouldn't be crashing on you. Like, it shouldn't like, there shouldn't be missing artwork, like, you know what I mean? Like, there's a level of quality there, and with a lot of these, I don't know.
How about you, Jordan? I mean, do you get games in your cereal boxes?
I don't remember that at all. And I think a large part of it was that, you know, I was 20 something at the era that they're talking about here, and I wasn't buying kids cereal, right?
So wait, you didn't have candy for breakfast? Poor you.
I did not have candy for breakfast.
Okay, so we're going to skip that one, and we're going to move on to the next one. And this one
is
probably
going to
make all our eyes light up with this one. Gaming magazines as thick as Bibles. Before the internet.
I was just talking about this.
What's it called? Magazines were the go-to place for gaming news, previews, and reviews. They were like holy scriptures to gamers, and issues had like 200-page counts. And why was this possible? Well, there was a crap ton of ads, you know.
Right.
But on the other hand, for a lot of people like me, we love the ads because this is usually where the first time we'd even learn of a game. you know.
And it's also was also the era of a fantastic magazine, well, back then, called Computer Shopper, which was the same premise. It was as thick as a phone book, came out every month, and all it was advertising.
Well, not only that, but also, remember, you also had the mail order services in them, too.
Correct.
And they would all be competing with themselves, and you get some really great prices on stuff, you know?
That's correct, yeah. Yes, Computer Shopper was fantastic.
But I'm going to say this. I loved the ads most of all. I mean, I was always looking through the ads to see if there was something new that was going to grab my eye. You know, this is where I first learned of, say, Civilization, you know. And even as late as 2000, you know, it was the first time I learned of stuff like Baseball Mogul. You know, you remember those little ads for these, I guess you call them indie games now. But they were not the big splashy ads, but these little boxes in the sidebar for this one game, like Surgeon Simulator, you know, that sort of thing.
The thing that I found fascinating was all of the infighting between Nintendo and Sega. You know, Sega would run an ad that would say Sega does what Nintendo
don't. Yeah.
And then Nintendo ran ads when the PlayStation and Saturn were launching, basically pushing the Super Nintendo, saying, no, no, 16-bit is fine. You don't need anything more than 16-bit, which everybody thought was hilarious.
Well, we're going to move on to Paul here, who has every single issue of Nintendo Power ever released.
I was just going to bring that up. You know me far too well. So I subscribed to Nintendo Power for like the entire 27-year run. I remember back before it had any ads at all. And they were just as big. And the magazine itself was physically larger than, you know, before it had ads to after it had ads. But yeah, man, the ads were the beginning of the end.
Well, with Nintendo Power, though, the big thing about Nintendo Power were the guides. And that was the biggest part of why all the kids wanted to buy the Nintendo Power, because they had all the guides. Like we mentioned before, some games were virtually unplayable without having the guide, you know?
Well, I mean, aside from that, like when video game guides first even became a thing, Nintendo Power was running every other month at the time.
Right.
And when they had made the paradigm shift to try to become monthly, they would still have Nintendo Power on the odd numbered months, but on the even numbered months, they would mail you a strategy guide. And it was probably for a game you didn't even have.
Those strategy guides are also a way to get people to buy them too, you know?
Right. I mean, they launched it with Final Fantasy. And then they did a whole bunch of other ones that I don't remember. I used that Final Fantasy one, let me tell you. But I think the last time they did it was like the 4-player Kinect issue. And then at that point, they just like were Nintendo Power 12 months a year. But yeah, that was one of the, that was to me the birth of strategy guides, was that first Final Fantasy one.
Somewhere around here, I have an entire box of Electronic Gaming Monthly from the early 1980s.
I see a PC Gamer right down there on the bottom of the thing that I'm pretty sure is probably from 2002 or something. I mean, not that old. I mean, the oldest things I might have are from 1995. And one of the things is, and I'm pretty sure Paul's done this, is to go back to some issue and just read about a game that's new, but it's like 20 years old now, and just see, you know, and see what people were saying about these previews and all that stuff.
Right. Oh, man, to hell with that. Nintendo Power used to have this, like, celebrity player pulse in the back. I remember when, you know, finding out what Will Wheaton thought of video gaming was the height of cool.
What about Ace Ebb? Do you remember Ace Ebb? He was in the first Nintendo Power player. Nintendo Power player who was featured in the very first Nintendo Power, and they bragged about him. Our club is called the NES Masters. We know right off who our Power player is. His name is Ace Ebb. He writes to Nintendo all the time, telling about his accomplishments on games. His hobbies are playing Nintendo games, period. He has no pets. Instead, he plays Nintendo all day. He beat Metroid in 3 days, Tyson in 5, saved Zelda in 5, and finished Super Mario Brothers in 5. This is not a real kid. I'm pretty sure that he never existed. Because right now, from our eyes, hearing that he has no pets and all he does is play Nintendo all day, and we would think, he's kind of sad.
Well, just because he's kind of sad doesn't mean it wasn't real. My bigger point is the fact that listening to those times, he's not exactly a power player.
There is actually one real one we know for a fact is real. One of the power players was someone by the name of Cliff Bleszinski.
That was hilarious.
He was the top scorer. Oh, I forgot which game it was. But he has the highest score ever for that game, and it still hasn't been beaten.
Excitebike or something.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
So we're going to move on to the next one. I never really dealt with this, but I'm pretty sure Paul did, and probably Jordan too, since he was an older gamer. Cartridge cleaning kits. Game cartridges were designed in such a way that exposes the contacts to open air. If you neglected to put your games back in your box or protector, all sorts of bad news is bound to occur. Dirt, dust, and general griminess was bound to get into the cartridge slot, and the common solution of blowing air into the plastic slot was actually contributing to the cartridge failure. Experts knew how to skip all that frustration and go straight to the cleaning kit when their game refused to start up. This usually included a special cleaning solution applied via delicate cloth or cotton swabs. Did you ever have to use a cartridge cleaning kit?
No, because all the cartridge cleaning kit was cotton swabs and rubbing alcohol.
That's not true. Actually, they had, if you look at the cartridge cleaning kit, they actually had special things. You can put your cartridges in it and do certain things with it. How about you, Jordan?
No, I never had a problem with any of my cartridges. But, you know, the people that wrote this article missed a perfect opportunity here, because there is a cartridge that was used in the same fashion as a cleaning kit, and they just kind of blew it off. Game Genies.
Nobody uses a Game Genie anymore.
Game Genie.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in a second. But, yeah, I mean when they say like blowing into it was causing part of the problem, yeah. If you were blowing hard,
yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between your breath contains water moisture, you know, water vapor. That's the problem, isn't
it? Right, but sometimes that helped.
Really?
Sometimes that helped. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Make it a little more conductive. Yeah, sometimes that helped. But like, I mean, the difference between like, well, I don't want to get too gross, but you gotta treat your NES cartridge, especially as they get old, like a lover. You don't really wanna create a wind tunnel while blowing in her ear. You wanna, you know, a nice seductive blowing.
Yeah, your cartridge is a slot. So, now we have, of course, now we have the modern equivalent. That's dirty disc, and that's when your disc gets scratched.
Yep.
And it irritates the heck out of
your disc, or your disc drive fails. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course now with digital, that's becoming less and less of a problem these days too. Now, this one I remember, and Jordan hinted at it back then with little Sega does what Nintendo don't, and you had the corny gaming commercials.
I'm gonna link you to my favorite corny gaming commercial.
Oh, it has to be. Wait. You know, here's the thing. The first one I remember that was corny was that one for the first Smash Brothers, you know, and they're talking about how happy, friendly, you know, what's it called, prancing through a field, and then they start beating the crap out of each other.
Right.
Wait, video game commercials are so corny.
They are.
Well, what about, how about this? Mortal Kombat!
That was awesome. What are you talking about?
That was corny. Come on. People screaming Mortal Kombat over and over. Although
you're dead inside.
I hope you have a way of stealing the audio off of my favorite one and putting it into the podcast.
How about the PlayStation 2 commercial that talked about the PS9?
The inhalable PS9. Yeah. Yes.
how about it's the Legend of Zelda and it's really rad. Those monsters from Ganon are pretty bad. Octorox Tektites and Levers too, but with your help, our hero pulls through. Wiki, wiki, wee! Awesome! Intense! The Nintendo Entertainment System.
How about the Pitfall commercial with a very young Jack Black in it? And he was the first thing you saw. I still have that commercial for Atari. Every single commercial for Atari had that jingle. Have you played Atari today? Remember that jingle?
I don't remember that jingle?
Have you played Atari today? Okay, now you're the ones who have no souls.
Well, you're old.
No, actually, these were in the...
Go back to farting mummy dust.
These were in the late 80s when they were still trying to...
Jonah and I are the same age, and I don't remember that.
I'm a year younger than you, so...
Oh, are you a year younger?
Because if you were 21 and 90, then...
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I mean, it's too bad we really can't, you know. And that's going to basically conclude our little gaming, you know, things that you couldn't do back then.
There's one more here.
What? There's no more?
But there's one more here.
There's one more here.
Yeah, it says fond memories. It says it right there.
Yeah, but so those are just fond memories. I'm pretty sure the entire point is the fact we have fond
memories. My ride's here.
Oh, yeah. So, anyway.
Hey, the picture showed a cover of Nintendo Power magazine that I remember fondly. Volume 28. Man, that was a long time.
Yeah. So, that leads to the question of the week. What gaming activities do you no longer do? Again, the point is that, you know, stuff that you used to do when you were a gamer that is now obsolete. It's not because you got bored with it. It's just because it makes no sense to do it anymore. And already Paul has one that he wants to bring up. Go ahead, Paul.
A gaming activity that I no longer do. I no longer care about completing games.
Oh.
Like it used to be this giant status symbol. It's like, oh yeah, dude, I made it to the end of Zelda.
Oh yeah,
like
I beat Tyson. Yeah, I beat Tyson.
Yeah, I beat Tyson. Like, dude, I never even finished Skyward Sword. Do you know why? I got too much other shit to play.
I am in the same boat. On the Xbox games, I think I've gotten all 1,000 gamer points on like two games, and that's it.
Well, I mean, that's something different.
Oh, I totally don't care about achievements. Those things are stupid.
That's something else. I mean, we're talking about just completing the narrative of a game or getting to the end versus the end. I mean, I'm not the sort of person who does the 1,000 achievement thing either. I mean, there are people who do.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Well, additionally, I also don't like care to run around every side quest ever made in a game.
I actually,
like, for the same reason, though, too much other things.
It depends on the side quest.
I enjoy the side quest. Well, not unless they're tedious, but I enjoy side quests. It's just that, you know, I mean, let's not, you know, every game had collectathons in them anyway. I mean, look at DuckTales, right? You had to collect everything. I mean, that's basically, but you didn't get a pat on the back from the game for doing it, you know. They had that ending in which you were super rich. That's the only thing I can think of. Jordan, what do you not do anymore in terms of...
The biggest thing that I don't do anymore, and it's not exclusive to games, in that there really isn't the whole lineup to get this anymore, right? Used to be if you wanted the big game, you'd have to stand in line and hope that, you know, you were the right number person in line to get your game.
You didn't pre-order?
Now with pre-orders and all of that stuff, it's all gone away.
Hold on.
You know what?
I had to pre-order 94 to get Civilization 2.
Yeah, you know what? I kind of agree with you, Jordan, but I don't know that it's less of a thing as much as, you know, I just stopped caring. It's like, oh, so big. I hate paying retail for anything anyway. But I mean, like, I still don't have an Xbox 4. No, a PS4 and an Xbox One.
Well, here's the thing.
Yeah, I mean? I don't care that I'm not going to get it in time for Christmas. Well, I'm not going to run around like a crazy person or stand in line.
Jordan, I know that that it was very easy for you to get the hot consoles. You know, you used to, but that's something that no longer happens, is that you no longer have... You know, you have the midnight sales, but it's like a few days later, there'll still be console available, you know? Right.
Yeah, it's less of a status symbol now.
It's not less of a status symbol. It's more like they overproduce, you know, just in case.
Well, it's not just limited to gaming, too. When's the last time you saw a line around a movie theater, right? It doesn't happen anymore.
Actually,
the Harry Potter series opening night of Harry Potter series. I mean, that's about it.
I know what you're talking about,
Jordan. The last time I saw a great big huge line for a movie was the first Lord of the Rings movie, and that was like 13 years ago now.
That's nothing. I remember this distinctly when Empire Strikes Back came out. 2 weeks later, you had a line twice around the block in New York City. I mean,
exactly.
You know, it wasn't like Cabaret had lines around the block a couple of times. Jaws.
Wait, The Empire Strikes Back?
The Empire Strikes Back, yeah.
I was like four, dude.
But I'm just saying.
I just named a much more recent example.
I get that. I'm just saying, you know, I'm talking about.
The lines for the Star Wars movies were insane.
But absolutely. That's why I saw The Empire Strikes Back in a second run theater. That's something we no longer have anymore. And it has nothing to do with video games. I miss the second run theaters.
Ooh, not true. We still have those. When I was in grad school in Florida.
When was this?
2009.
We have tons of second run theaters in Portland. They're brew pub theaters where you can sit down, have a beer and a pizza, and watch a movie.
Yeah, but it's not like a theater.
Jonah, I think your perception might be colored by the fact that you live in the largest city in the world.
I'm talking about the huge theater, and I'm not talking about revival theaters either. I'm talking about a huge theater that would show it, you know, again. And also, the St. Mark's Theater also had the morning matinee, so the first few times I saw The Wizard of Oz, I saw it on the big screen. You know,
yeah, there was a place like that in the town that I grew up in, and I got to see 2001 on the big screen.
I saw
a lot of stuff like that, Bang Bang,
and Dr. Doolittle, and you know,
Sinbad, the Sinbad movies, I got to see on the big screen.
I'm telling you guys, they have these things in Florida. This is not a dead thing.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's not a dead thing. I mean,
but you know, it's not as widespread anymore. That's what I'm saying.
But Portland is, you know, strange that way.
These theaters were $2. You know, that's the
exactly. Yeah,
I'm with you.
And they revived it briefly. I mean, they showed second run this theater, Jurassic Park, and it was filled to the gills. And people wanted to see that instead of the sneak peek of the Alec Baldwin superhero thing. I always get these two confused. Oh, The Shadow. Alec Baldwin was The Shadow, and Val Kilmer was the it was Billy Zane was. Oh, he was
the Phantom.
The Phantom.
The
right.
Phantom. Yeah.
So yeah.
There's a theater here in Portland called the Laurelhurst, which on my birthday a couple of years back did a double feature of Woody Allen's Sleeper and Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Revival theater. I mean, we have that. Yeah. We have the Cinema Village. We have the IFC Theater and all that stuff. I'm talking about second run new movies. You know, like seeing.
Yeah, yeah. They will do second run stuff too. Once it's out of the main theaters, it falls to this whole series of brew pub theaters.
You know, I remember. You know, they showed Blade Runner as a revival at Madison Square Radio City Music Hall on a massive screen, and I was actually the first to get in, and it was like 3,000 people watching Blade Runner again.
Yeah, Blade Runner was
the Music Hall.
That was the first R-rated movie I ever saw in a theater.
Yeah. So, anyways, that was the question of the week. What gaming activities? Not movie, please. We just went on a major, do you no longer engage in? And not because you're bored of it, but because it's silly to do it. It's obsolete, you know. So, look for our show notes at Gaming Podcast Net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles. If you enjoy our feedback, so leave us comments on our blog at Gaming Podcast Net. Also, hit us up at facebook.com/gamingpodcast or the forums at gamingpodcast.net/forum or send us comments to fans@gamingpodcast.net. You can also check out our gaming news at gamestudios.com. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, leave some iTunes comments, and you can still do Team USA's Pinsanity on Facebook.
Facebook, Android, and iOS.
So here's the thing is that I intended this just to be a short, you know, light episode, but, you know, we actually got in a long stuff in this history.
Well, we didn't exactly do hard-hitting news.
No, but it's still video game stuff, and, you know, we're still recording, which, thank God, I wouldn't have to do this again.
We did have to start over. I think we missed, like, half an hour.
We missed about 15 minutes.
Okay.
No, we missed 3 minutes. I mean, a lot of the time that you see there was just you getting logged on and logged off. I mean, the phone call has been going on. But I'd estimate we have, like, 50 minutes here, which is a lot more than I thought it would be. But anyways... Yeah. So anyways, let us know about your gaming nostalgia as well. If anything we said makes you go, ooh, I remember this and this and that, you know, because we want to hear from our people. We want some nice listener feedback. And
where my people at? Where my people at? Sorry.
Okay. Yes. Paul wants.
Oh, you know who you are. If you
Paul wants Alpha
you
Shard to call in and his other fans to call in.
We would like verification that people are still listening. That would be nice.
You know.
Because, you know, otherwise I'd like the 2 hours back in my week, frankly.
Anyways, we will see you next week. Until then, enjoy some retro reminiscing.
Good night, everybody.
Bye, Bonds.